JG2 Number 3A.
So we begin this morning, and what we can see is that for today we had scheduled the subject this morning concerning what actually is law. How does science define law? What is the scientific definition of law? And we want to see this now in the light of the world sciences, and then, of course, for the whole rest of our session will be in the light of Christian science. But it's very, very important to see the impact of the divine on the human, to see through the Christ and its translation and retranslation that the human must be overcome, that the divine must overcome the human at every single step. Therefore, we see the power impact of the laws of God breaking in as light, as revelation, as inspiration to the world scientists, those prepared to hear that melody of the laws of being. We saw last evening that we go through laws and pass the study of laws into the realm of laws themselves, where those laws really are operating as the music of the spheres, as the art of the spheres, as the being of the spheres, where we have gone from the irrational through the rational to the irrational through the revealed texts, such as the Bible, Science and Health, the Model of Being, where we have gone through books and past books into being itself, into this realm of science itself. Now, this realm of science itself, the 8,000-year period, really is that realm that has, of course, then its vertical impact on the world. They already begin to see in world consciousness today that they're not so interested in how the past determines the now, but much more interested in how the future determines the now. We know that this was something that Rupert Sheldrake wrote in his book, The Past is Present, where they begin to see and saw how that the DNA, really a universal collective and individual beliefs passed on through the DNA, was determining our present status and standpoint of consciousness. But they also, in working with the laws of the very small in quantum physics, quantum means breaking something down into very small, began to see there are other laws happening between the laws of besides the laws of cause and effect. They saw that there were also these laws happening within the very small realm of being, and within the realm of atoms and even smaller particles than that, that things happen spontaneously and that they could not be determined. They began in quantum physics then to take their inductive reasoning, reasoning out from these laws of spontaneity that happen in the very small, and began to generalize them concerning the universe. Always a dangerous thing to do when you take something very small and generalize it so large as building cosmological principles on quantum physics. But they took the courage to do that and has given us a new look at cosmology and the worldview because of what they have seen of these other laws happening in the realm of the very small. So we see that in the larger view of everyday happenings, they were just working with mainly with these laws of causality, how the past determines the now, and with this discovery of this holistic universe that Einstein brought in, as opposed to the mechanistic world of Newton, or let's just say it built on and includes the mechanistic world of Newton, but not leaving Newton's world as the only view of reality, but to see that that whole clockwork universe, based on the laws of motion and the laws of gravity, were okay. But it got in danger of being such a reductionistic worldview that they began to reduce everything down till they finally got to knowing a lot about very little. And that's that reductionistic view where you take the whole, and it's necessary, it's a method of science, to take the whole and reduce it to law and begin to see all the various parts operating within that whole. It really became a machine universe where the parts were equal to the sum of the whole. Then we know that Einstein came along and looked at Newton's world of the mechanistic world of reductionism and his laws of motion and gravity, and was looking at his concept of time and began to see there was an irregularity concerning his concept of time, and built a whole new paradigm, which usually happens around the anomaly of the old paradigm, or the irregularity or anomaly, they mean the same thing, around the anomaly or irregularity of the old paradigm of Newton, which was time. Einstein built his whole theory then of the space-time continuum on a multidimensional, fourth-dimensional space-time continuum. This brought in a holistic way of reasoning with the world, where we went from reductionism of reducing the whole to its parts, one method of science, now with the accentuation on the other method of science of bringing everything together, synthesis, where now the little parts are being tied together into the whole. Really a same method we know that Mrs. Eddy used, but she didn't call it the method of science. She was talking to a very religious age, we know, of the 19th century. Newton was just beginning to work. As we'll see this morning, the concepts of science were just getting established. And so she gave us what was called the synonymy principle. When she gave us the definition for God as mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love, right after that she asks, are these terms synonymous? And she says they are, when they refer to God. But she says they also are intended to bring out the nature, essence, and wholeness of deity. For their attributes of God are, and then she gives various attributes. So her synonymy principle is based on reductionism, where we could see then through the Dorley work in the late 30s that she saw that this infinite principle could be reduced to its nature of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love. And that nature then could be reduced and explained through the various ideas that characterize that nature. Complete reductionism from the whole down to its specifics. But as we know, she didn't leave the specifics in isolation. She gathered them all together through the lens of science, she said, where when they're blending together in a synthesis, they bring at the focal point of spirit light instantaneously. So she also was using the method of science of analysis and synthesis. So we see today that this whole method of synthesis then is gathering everything back into the larger view. So we see that too in the world sciences today. They are interested always in that cosmological universal view. And as I say, they have taken now what they see in the very small and begin to see and generalize it and say, well, we aren't bound just by the laws of cause and effect, how the past determines the now. But we see that the universe is governed by other laws. In fact, we see it as holistically as a self-organizing, self-regulating, non-linear system that is always coming spontaneously forth from its origin. This is what Paul Davies, a scientist who has written the book Cosmic Blueprint, has shown us in his book. And if you had heard my tapes last year on the model of being, it holds the key to the future of man. I basically that class, when I talked about the various sciences, on his book, The Cosmic Blueprint, which shows, therefore, as a scientist, he was showing how all the scientists begin now not to look to the past to determine the now, but to look to the future. They see that events are happening spontaneously and directly from a self-organizing system. And we know the scientists are talking much more today how ideas come to them. Einstein himself, as we'll see, says there is no logical way to arrive at the laws that he discovered. They come through inspiration, and then they're verified. Over and over, these scientists show that most of their discoveries that are important have come through intuition, through revelation, but they'd rather call it inspiration. Something higher is thinking them. And we saw that with the experiment at the Max Planck Institute that Max Kepler writes about in his booklet, Man, the Thinker, the Thought, where they see then that these laws of life, which we call life, but they call the law of the exponential growth of knowledge, we call life, then this law of the inner logic of knowledge, we call truth, and then this law of inner goal-directedness, we call love, teleology that's been around since Aristotle, that these three laws, they say, are the inner laws of science that make science go forward on these impersonal laws that are thinking the scientists. So as we saw last evening, the scientist doesn't determine where science goes. Science determines what the scientist must think. This is becoming so prevalent, and that's why they begin to know that there is some type of a self-organizing, self-regulating, non-linear, spontaneous laws behind the universe. So this whole question of laws are very important, not only in the light of Christian science, as we'll spend the bulk of our sessions together, but also in the light of world science. So I want to spend this morning just with working with this concept of law and what it means. And then as we have scheduled this afternoon, beginning to see how that law works in the light of Christian science, beginning with the law of the level of science itself. But to keep that law of the level of science itself from becoming too much abstract glory or mysticism or taken just on the realm of belief and not understanding, which it could do because it is very, very abstract. It deals with very, very simple symbols, very abstract symbols that demand a lot of science and understanding concerning concept building, tonality building, consciousness building, and being building with the synonymous terms and their fourfold operation on the levels. It's a very advanced subject. To keep it from being abstract glory as we learn it, and many of us have touched on it now for many years, we need to spend time just knowing what law is to appreciate this whole subject that we're taking together about laws. It sets the foundation and fundamental of a subject. And you know that I've taken introductory classes now in the summer school since 1975 and have taught introductory classes since 1970, beginning in Seattle. And I just feel that a subject only goes forward because the foundation is well built. I think we all agree on that. If we skip the fundamentals, we're always at sea. I saw that right away as an artist right out of the University of Washington, teaching at a time at the University of Washington, and then spending the bulk of my professional teaching career in art at a professional art college in Seattle, where I saw that the artists that came into my classes always wanted to jump right away into abstract expressionistic art, not really realizing that art and music and literature as the sciences are all based on fundamentals, on a basic a structure of music, structure of art, structure of literature that has to be understood. And the artist has to understand the anatomy of nature and the structure of nature through realistic art, being able to really draw a tree through understanding anatomy of a tree, to be able to really draw a figure by understanding the anatomy of a figure. Therefore, all the famous artists, all of them, Picasso, any of them that became great abstract artists, knew the fundamentals, they drew the fundamentals, and then from those basic fundamentals began to abstract out just what was essential, leaving the non-essential behind, but abstracting out the essential. And that's what laws are. Laws are a method of abstraction, taking the very basic fundamentals and abstracting out that which is essential. And then that essential nature of what called a law covers then a multitude of phenomenon. So it's more or less a law is extracted through the method of reductionism, that which is essential to a multitude of phenomenon. It's extracted out of that multitude of phenomenon, the essential nature of that phenomenon, and then that essential nature or abstraction or a method of economy called law governs the multitude of phenomenon. So this understanding of just what it is that makes a law, is much more important, actually, I think, than just knowing the laws. One has to know what it is, how a law is defined. So we look first then at the laws as they are defined in the world sciences. And I was quite impressed, as I'm sure many of you were, with this Time magazine article of December 28, 1992. If you don't have it, I'm sure you can find it in the public library. It says, "What does science tell us about God?" An incredible article. And in here is that which Paul Davies is quoted in here, talking about his book, The Cosmic Blueprint, and then the book I'm going to talk about today that he just has recently wrote, The Mind of God. Davies himself, as I said, is a scientist who has worked out of England for a long time in Newcastle, which was up at the border between England and Scotland. Presently, he's teaching in Australia. I think he has presented two of the most powerful books on science as reduced for the layman to understand. He's quoted in this terrific article here, which really, if one reads it, there's no longer one would ever feel that there's a conflict going to occur between science, God, and man. That when Mrs. Eddy shows in that sixth chapter, and Max has brought this out many, many times, of course, in his work with the textbook, and I just underlined what he had said when I took the class on science, theology, and medicine in first part in 1988 at a summer school, and the second part in 1989, really seeing how that class was, that chapter was the backbone of the textbook. Her chapter on science, theology, and medicine comes at the standpoint of the Christ as the Christ in the matrix of the textbook. And we know that the matrix of the textbook, the backbone of any matrix is always its diagonal. And therefore, in the diagonal of the matrix, you get the strongest tone of the textbook through the Word is the Word chapters, the Christ is the Christ, Christianity is Christianity, and science is science. Well, science, theology, and medicine comes at the standpoint, as we know, as Christ is the Christ, which is the main tone overlying roof category of the textbook is, as we know, the 6,000-year period of truth, which is the standpoint of the Christ, which is the standpoint of the Christ idea, where principal God, as we saw last evening, is presenting what we are as idea. And then through the law of opposites, the second translation takes everything that isn't like God and brings it back to the standard of God. Therefore, in her article, chapter, Science, Theology, and Medicine, Mrs. Eddy says so clearly that all science is divine. There is no physical science. If these physical science wants to call these laws of God physical, fine, but they are not physical. That it's only the universe of God, and the only laws going on are the laws of God, and those laws are spiritual. She is even as bold to say that science traces all physical laws and effects back to a spiritual cause. How have we ever been able to live with the fact that all physical effects can be traced back to a spiritual cause? Meaning that there is nothing physical. The physical is unreal. It's only the spiritual misunderstood. What we call matter is just spirit misunderstood, called matter. It doesn't make it matter. Just because of ignorance, somebody calls spirit matter, doesn't make it matter, does it? No. Silly. So that's why Mrs. Eddy says that there is no life, truth, intelligence in the matter concept in the scientific statement of being. She says it's not a reality. She says all is infinite mind, in its infinite manifestation, for God is all in all. Spirit is the immortal truth, doesn't she say? And matter is mortal error. Spirit is the real and eternal. Matter is the unreal and temporal. Spirit is God, and man is his image and likeness. Therefore, man is not material, he is spiritual. Now, if the scientists want to call it physical, as I said, fine. It doesn't make it physical. So when you go through this, it takes a tremendous amount of spiritual sense and an understanding of the spiritual categories. But you can hear through scientific text interpretation based on the synonymous term, you hear the melody of the impact of God on the universe, analyzing, uncovering, annihilating the false physical definition, naturally goes into a more mental definition, and finally it's coming into a much more spiritual explanation of laws, as we are going to see right now. So, taking then a look at this subject, we see then that Mrs. Eddy then defined God as principle, and therefore we see then that principle as defined in Webster is a fundamental truth, semicolon, a comprehensive law or doctrine from which others laws or doctrines are derived, or on which other laws or doctrines are founded. Semicolon, a general truth. So she revolutionized the world, as we discussed last evening, with this definition of God. She revolutionized the sciences, she revolutionized theology, and she revolutionized medicine, putting it all on the everything on the basis of a principle, which is called God, but which is defined as not an anthropomorphic deity sitting in heaven with white hair on a throne, but defined God as a capital principle, as the comprehensive law of the universe. That's how we would define God from the science level. She says that infinite principle includes them all, meaning that God is the comprehensive law of the universe, which includes all other laws. That's how we can say that level of science itself is that infinite law of being, that infinite law of self-reflection, that includes all the laws of divine science and its laws of divine self-organization, all the laws of absolute Christian science and its level law of divine spontaneity, and all the laws of Christian science on the laws of divine causality. All the many laws are all included within the one comprehensive law called God. So, therefore, this is the most important subject we could be discussing, is what is, therefore, the nature of law. We saw then that Mrs. Eddy introduced to the Bible the two terms, principle and mind. It was upon these two terms that her revelation of science and health was based, again, at truth at the 6,000-year period. The two-edged sword of truth having to do with principle and mind. Meaning she could have called her textbook Principle and Mind, but I guess that wouldn't have been so much understood. So instead of calling it principle, she said, well, principle is really a fixed principle God, and a fixed principle God rests on science and laws and orders and rules and system and structure and method and form and plan. So she thought, well, the best thing to do is call it science, which is based on a fixed principle. But she just didn't call it science, did she? There's a two-edged sword of the Christ translation. It's not only that principles, God, science comes to man as what is reality, but there's another side of the sword of truth, which is, of course, health. And we see now that health is based on a holistic consciousness, a healthy whole consciousness. In fact, the ideal healthy form of man is not judged by the physical nature of man we know now, but is a state of consciousness. It's a state of divine qualities of consciousness, that our form is the form of divine consciousness. We know that already on the human, hopefully, we don't judge others by the way they look. That when somebody comes up to us, we don't identify them by their hair or their face or how tall they are or how short they are or any other physical feature. We see that we identify someone by their qualities, whether their qualities are intelligence, patience, perseverance, honesty, being non-critical, having the sense of truth, logic, love, compassion. We judge them all according to these qualities of God. Those qualities of God form our consciousness, and our ideal form of health is how it standardizes itself to the ideal standard of reference. That constitutes our health, is how our qualities relate to the standard, impersonal, absolute standard of God, as we have seen in the ascending way. So health stands for a healthy whole consciousness.